I want to thank you all for coming out on a beautiful day. It's rare for me to say beautiful day in January coming from Minnesota, where I scraped the ice off my windshield this morning. But it's a real pleasure to be here and to be hosted by IPDI and GW here. And I want to thank a number of the co-sponsors that helped to organize this event. And they're on a slide up here, and I'll read it off when I get there. We're going to talk over there. Sunlight Foundation, thank you for the refreshments. Shoka, the Deliberative Democracy Consortium, and the Center for Democracy and Technology. In past years, when I've come into town, I've often hung out at CDT, and we've had little roundtable discussions with about 15 to 20 people. And we decided to try something this time a little bigger. So we got about 50 people that RSVP'd, and instead of it being just me talking one way for 3-4 hours, we're going to do about an hour presentation and have a break. Short one to gather whatever refreshments are left and come on back in for a solid 50 minutes or so of discussion on a number of themes. So a real chance to interact. And if you do have a question at any point, you can actually push the little microphone button so everyone can hear you clearly. And it'll also help me pick up the audio as I try to record today here. So here we go. So the rough agenda. Also, we're going to record this, FYI. We're going to talk about e-democracy and governance. Going to do a little Citizens Online part of that. A little restocking break like I talked about. And you may have picked up a copy of the How E-Government is Changing Society and Strengthening Democracy publication from the GSA. An amazing collection of articles. And I'm going to put them on the spot. I want to have them give us a minute or two to explain what's in there. And if there are any authors for any of those chapters, I'm going to want to have you, during the discussion part, just acknowledge yourself and give us the one-minute description of what you wrote about to help us get into our discussion. Well, move this out of the way here. Back in 1994, a group of citizens in Minnesota thought it would be really fun, to put candidates for governor and U.S. Senate on this brand new thing called the World Wide Web. And ended up being a group in Minnesota that created the world's first election website. That's how I got started in this. And it was quite a whirlwind, you know. People calling from all over the world, is this the end of politics as we know it? I ended up actually working in state government at the time as well. So I always describe myself as government by day and citizen by night. So I was running the portal in 95, the homepage for state of Minnesota. But I had this project that was called E-Democracy as a citizen. And when the election was over, people kept talking in our forum about the Minnesota politics. And we discovered how important it was to become a trusted, neutral host of online dialogue, to bring people together from across the political spectrum. Well, I left state government in 97, thought it would be fun to focus more on democracy than services, or it's more to my passion, really, and ended up somehow speaking in 27 different countries about democracy in the net, gathering stories everywhere I went. And as I went to Europe many times, you know, people would talk about Minnesota and the new politics, and this is 1996. This is before Howard Dean. That's like the background here. So we got a lot of energy, a lot of stories that were generated based on what was happening in Minnesota. And it culminated in 98 with Ventura. And it's legitimate to say that he could not have been elected without the internet. Now, he could not have been elected without a feather boa or a sign, you know, yard signs. But it was really the first candidate that I run into where the internet allowed him to go around the media and replace the lack of a campaign infrastructure and surprise everyone and win. So that was a great story. So everywhere I went, I could talk about Ventura, the pro wrestler, and people had heard of it. Before that, it was Minnesota. It was Prince, Bob Dylan. And then for a while, it was Fargo. That was like the big thing, the movie Fargo. But Ventura was definitely a great way to connect with people around the world. 2004 or so, I was flying to Mongolia. I was looking out the window over China. And, you know, sun setting, and I was just like, how in the heck did I get here? A little Minnesota boy flying into Mongolia, of all places, talk about e-democracy. I spent 8 days in Mongolia, and it was amazing. And I was looking at my hotel room. I don't know how well you can see this, but I turned the TV on, and lo and behold, there's a Russian game show, some kind of strange local news, and then there was Joe Trippi at the Politics Online conference on my television in Mongolia. Nowhere I've ever traveled have I found C-SPAN in another country, and here it is in Mongolia, of all places. Here you got a country with, what, 2 to 4% online, trying to figure out how can they use these tools to improve their democracy. Their president, or their prime minister, excuse me, actually has a website where they release draft legislation in both English and in Mongolian, to gather comments. Here in the presidency chamber here, they actually had what I would call a really nice flash animation on the wall. It was an old-fashioned wire and plastic board where you push different buttons and you can see the roads and the pipelines of, you know, and the different infrastructure of Mongolia. And to me, it was like the ultimate expression of what we often do on computers today. So I'll talk a little bit about candidates really quickly, because I got a lot of slides here. Folks pretty much know this, but my general sense is that something special is happening this election. I mean, Dean, that was important. 2004, you know, there's a lot going on then. McCain in 2000 was important as well. But people's expectations, in my opinion, related to how the candidates are now using the web, it's getting into the mass of society. It's not just the political class that are kind of excited about raising money. People are actually tuning into more and more of the online aspect of the campaign. You know, for the most part, they're gathering our emails. They're communicating with us, introducing the candidate to new voters. They're activating the supporters. And the thing that seems really pretty new this cycle is what I call the digital parade. Instead of candidates just trying to get you to come to their website, they're coming to you. And that's kind of the transformative piece. The campaigns, like they do a physical parade, they're going out to it and interacting with people where they are versus trying to bring them just to their site. And that's quite notable. The question I'd like to pose for this conversation today is, what about November 5th? So we've armed up. We've figured out how to use these tools to get out our voters, and we got 50% plus one. And there's a great article from 2004 that analyzed the different blog posts, and you had sort of the left and the right linking to each other, really working to influence the media pundits, and very little linkages across them. And very few, you know, blogs that were truly independent or more or less moderate in the middle. And I do view this as what I call a virtual civil war. I mean, we are arming up ourselves to campaign, but when the election's over, we haven't really thought a lot about or haven't really built the infrastructure to better represent, to better govern. Think about yourself. If you were in the next White House, you know, how would you use these tools? It's a question to think about in round two, to actually better connect with people, to bridge the divides, to think about how to build trust or capacity in communities from the local level up to solve problems. You know, how do we use these tools to bring people together versus organize or advocate from one side or the other? So there's a recent article. I did a top 10 tips article as part of the GSA series, and I'm going to go through those in my presentation. It's kind of a sub-point there, but there's also a lot of really good governmentally produced e-democracy, e-participation work out of the UK, and it's icele.org, some acronym, but icele.org. So first, most important thing that the government needs to do is provide timely, personalized access to information that matters. It's not all that useful to have access to information a week after the meeting took the decision. If people get access to information when they can act upon it, that empowers them. And so helping people find it when it's released versus stuck in a needle in a haystack is what this is about. We also need to, it's the number one thing when I talk to elected officials around the world, they talk about email. Not as if they hate it, but as if they just don't know how to handle it, right? And they want to handle it, but they don't have the tools to handle it, to sort, understand, respond. And they haven't figured out that they just need to tell the folks that run the parliaments and the legislatures that to spend some money to give them the tools. They're kind of taking what's given to them, which is basically Outlook and a few filters for most elected officials. And that's a problem. So an example, St. Paul. There are over 400 documents in St. Paul that change once a year. Sometimes they change once a week. Whenever they like, once a year. You can go and you can subscribe to any of these 400 documents. Now that's delivery. That's service. I can tell. I can find out when information is new. I can go to a democracy portal in Queensland, Australia, where they basically have pulled together all the different democratic aspects, not just the parliament, but also the executive, and helps you navigate, you know, ways to have your say. I really like what the DOT, federal DOT, does with their e-rulemaking site. You can actually see what's the most popular docket in the system. I don't know why this wasn't the model for what they were looking at for other agencies, but I'm interested in what I call, you know, hot links, democratized navigation. What happened today on the congressional website on House.gov that is notable so that I might want to go there too? When you go to download.com, right, what do? You don't just go alphabetically. You say, what's most popular? Well, that's a technological way to allow previous users to help the next set of users find their way around. There's also the ability to do personalized tracking, to be able to say, tell me when something happens in my area related to something I'm interested in. Google alerts, right? You know, news alerts. Why don't we have more of those in government, or how can we build some of those? You hear a lot about feeds, web feeds, RSS. I think it's relatively overblown in the sense that only less than 10% of the folks are using these things directly. They're good way for blogs to communicate with one another and to aggregate and the like, but you should at least have them combined, in my opinion, with the email option. But Alberta has a great, they've actually organized all of the press releases from all the different ministries into one comprehensive communication system. That's also very important, to pull things together. The right to petition government, so that's the whole listening thing, right? So the UK, they take their Magna Carta pretty seriously. They think about their history of the right to petition. There's been a number of projects in Scotland to allow petitioning. But instead of petitioning being done on the advocacy side, they're actually installing petitioning systems in government. And so my society helped build a system for petitioning on the Prime Minister's website. And they've had apparently up to 7%, or over 7% now, of the British population have gone to the Prime Minister's website and signed a petition. Anyone can create one. They vet out the McDonald Duck, the Prime Minister type of petitions. They had over 1 million people sign one petition about road pricing taxation. That generated lots of headline front page story in the print version of the Times. Very interestingly enough, they actually give the person who starts the petition the ability to send 2 email updates to everybody else who signs it. So they realize that they're not creating a whole toolkit for advocacy for the citizen, but they're going to give them just a little bit, and enough that allows them to communicate back to say, here's what happened. And then typically, the ministry will, if it's big enough, they'll respond with a letter of some kind. Another inbox issue, mobile technology. So Estrada, you may remember a few years ago, the president of the Philippines kind of got driven out because of corruption, and this is the next president, and texting is much more popular there than in many places. And so you can now text the president of the Philippines. So number 3 and number 9, I kind of mix these up a little bit here. Dedicate at least 10% of new government developments to democracy. The reason I left state government after we got $1 million for the best funded state portal was that I didn't think that any of it was going to have anything to do with democracy, because everybody wanted services. And here's what it's all about. Government gets really, really, really excited when they help you pay your taxes. The tax websites are the most usable website at state and national level. Great. And that's a good thing. But when I think of democracy in government, I think of focus groups. I think of post-transaction surveys. I think of usability testing, not just, you know, an online survey, you know, the things that I would also like to see, but just any kind of element built into what government is providing online that allows them to learn something about what citizens want. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to automate what we've always done, and then that allows us to gather lots of information from people about, do they actually want this service anymore, and the like. So I've also found that a lot of the countries that I visited are the leading services countries. So they did services first, and now they're like, oh, we talked about democracy when we started this, Queensland, for example. We better do something about it. And so if you look at a lot of the early rhetoric around e-government, it was about democracy and service. While I say don't wait to get your services all done right, I am finding that the leading service places are coming back to democracy. I'm also a big fan of figuring out ways to do some open source sharing in sort of this e-participation, e-democracy niche. You know, it's relatively undeveloped. The system for sorting email, or the system for online rulemaking, or the system for federalspending.gov, you know, systems like that. How could those types of tools be developed and shared? Let me talk about, can I give you a couple of examples in this space? So Estonia is like the e-society. It's fascinating. And they had, in 1998, they started this site called Today I Decide. The former prime minister was at an event, and he launched it off and said, we launched this site that allowed people to basically submit proposals, debate them, vote on them, and then have a government agency respond. This was on a government website. And we didn't know what we were doing, but we just did it. And so you have a whole number of experiments like that, and they're now trying to revamp their software, actually talking about doing an open source, and they got some European Union funding, which is pretty cool. But, you know, a lot of the days where people just did something and they didn't really know why they were doing it, they just thought it'd be fun, those days are over. Now we actually have to have political intent. And so that's what's happening now in Estonia, where they're actually deepening. They have a thing called a document register, where if civil servants actually develop documents. This is quite amazing. They actually, as they like first register them, they actually show up on a publicly accessible website. And I thought, well, like a draft? And they're like, yeah. And so apparently when the system first came online, you know, some civil servant wrote up a proposal for some tax increase on something or this or that, and the media picked up on it. And then the ministry said, well, that's like seven layers down. And the media's like, oh, okay, never mind. Which I found was a big surprise. But the challenge, obviously, is that this culture has decided after, you know, communism, right, that maybe they need to trust their government, which maybe means, you know, they need to provide deep transparency. And the media said, okay, which surprises me, but, you know, it's what happened there. You can also vote online there, which is very interesting. You have this chip card here with strong encryption. A lot of people have little readers, the cheap readers they put in their computer. This is how they're not bank cards as well. Only like 1% actually vote online. It's a small percentage, and they've done it twice now. But what's really exciting about this system is that it allows you as an individual, type in your PIN, to see the private data that government holds about you, and to see when it's been accessed, and you're given a right to ask why it was accessed. So I was there with a guy named Ivar, who was showing me the system, and he popped up his digital version of his passport. And then he said, oh my gosh, I've been accessed 10 times recently. And I said, you know, you just told me over dinner that you're going to be sitting at the same table with President Bush when he comes to Estonia in 2 days. So one of the things that I've noticed is a big trend, right? So government is using more and more technology to protect us. It often knows much more about us. Well, maybe it should be a two-way street. Maybe we should know more about them, or us, really, because we are the government, right? And we should know more about what they know about us. And it's more about balance than anything, and that, I think, trust can come from that. So that's amazing. Another sort of democracy piece, timely information. Well, when should government tell you about elections? When there are elections coming up. If you go to most government portal sites and there's an election, there's not often not a mention of it. There's USA.gov. I mean, is there a link from there to a neutral Library of Congress page about the presidential election? I don't know. There could be. There should be, right? Or when I go to the state of Minnesota's portal and there's an election that day, shouldn't there be a direct link, very profile, to election information provided by government? For the most part, there hasn't been. When parliaments, you know, legislatures go out of session and they're getting ready for an election, do they link to information about elections? Typically not. And so Korea, although I don't know whether they actually link to across the net to government net to these different sites, they funded two major sites. They had a youth site where this is the best, right? So you send one of these e-postcards, you know, it was flash animation. And then after you send the postcard about cleaning up politics and corruption, it's great. You get a prize, right? Or you get to sign up for a prize. Government websites should give out prizes. This is just brilliant. And I think a lot of sites that have a civic mission to think about, you know, ringtones, you get a mouse, you can get a jump drive, a couple different things. They also had a very standard, this is highly interactive, they have discussion forums. They pay for advertising on commercial websites. You can upload videos. I watched a 10-minute video of people just dancing in these little outfits to some kind of election song. I don't know. 10 minutes. It's crazy. I just had to see what happened. They just kept dancing. Anyway, on the government site, they actually have a full index. Again, very broadband society, you can see all the candidates on the ballot, and there's an index of like six things about them. Their public information about them, their crime record, their tax record, their, their crime, campaign finance, you name it. The government had it about them, it was all in this one site. They had a discussion board about each candidate, they had a discussion board about all the candidates, which weren't so active, but you could discuss them. Here you could discuss the four candidates there. They had a government produced video. So they probably stood in front of that blue screen there or blue backdrop, and every candidate had a chance to do their 3-minute video or whatever it was, and a link off from the government website to the candidate's own website. Think about the talking ballot or the virtual ballot, right? So everybody gets so hyped up about e-voting. Voting is a transaction, okay? Whether it's online or in person, you want it to be secure. Trust is based on that. But the net can actually do so much more to promote informed voting. And a lot of media outlets aren't doing the voter guides they used to do, really down at the local level. And think about Dogcatcher and a lot of those folks aren't listed anywhere but when you go to the voting booth. We need to think about how we fund and develop rich voter guides. They also use technology in reverse in Korea. This is I think James Bond music in the background. And it's basically anti-corruption cyber. It basically says if you see a politician being bribed, take a picture with your camera phone and send it into the government right here. They had a just dramatic increase in reports of election law violations in Korea. And you wonder why. Because they decided to aggressively encourage people to actually submit complaints. There's some negative sides here. It's actually against the law in Korea to tell falsehoods about candidates or parties. And so they're trying to figure out whether to require real names on forums. Now, 4 years earlier, 3 years earlier, they actually had subsidized forums on commercial websites, and now they have this big problem that everyone's talking politics and everybody's freaked out by it. And they actually had an entire room of people, like that side, like these two areas here, they monitored 4,000 websites every day looking for falsehoods with the script, and then there was this guy with the law basically saying, did this violate the law or not? So they took the law very seriously. And they would ask people to remove content from sites that were violating the laws, and they hadn't quite figured out how to get to the people yet, and that was the real names thing. Next. Enough said about that. Tangent. So, number four, announce all government public meetings on the internet in a uniform manner. Right? So, I live in Minneapolis. We have not too far from a lock and dam, so we got some federal fish and wildlife stuff there, Army Corps of Engineers, they do meetings. I have my neighborhood meetings, I have my park board meetings, I have my library board meetings, I have my city council, state, you name it, right? It'd be really nice if I could plunk in my zip code and a few keywords and be told about meetings that were coming up that had agenda items based on the keywords that I'm interested in. And so I'm interested in a system-wide, standards-based system for announcing public meetings. And not only announcing them, then pulling in agendas, then pulling in handouts. And then eventually, I think laws should require that every public meeting, and 100 years from now, can you imagine that we wouldn't record every public meeting? So if it's going to happen in 100 years, maybe we need to change the laws now at state and local level, national level, to say, okay, it's a public meeting, at least have a digital audio recording of it. And then it has to go somewhere, not just be thrown away. Allow people to look up their elected officials at every level. Now, there are a number of commercial sites that do some of this, and some of them get really deep. I'm interested in making it possible for more sites to offer who represents me services. So to think about when a government body, this might be done at the state level, and then you aggregate it nationally, but basically when someone gets elected, that local government's responsibility is to submit that data up to the state database, so that it becomes accessible, so that we can create national who represents me systems, because that's the only way to really reach the mass of people, I think. Online public hearings and dialogues, I have some examples. One of the things that I've run into here, and the folks in the Sunlight can talk more about the congressional stuff that's going on during the discussion, but I just can't believe that we have all these different congressional committees with their own websites, their own servers. I mean, it's just crazy to me that we actually haven't aggregated the technology base and saved money that way and created, like, really nice looks and feels, like they have in Canada or, in this case, Scotland. And created some usability around this thing. Common templates, this being a congressional committee is not about expression. It's about representing and reaching people with information that's useful. And it would be really nice if we had some similar formats. How many of you have ever participated in a video-based online town hall meeting? Here in Wired America, I was in Iceland once, right? I asked, anybody heard of an online using video? Because everybody's wired here. No. Well, they have these little internet cafes hooked by low-bandwidth wireless connections using their own little software platform in India. And they actually organized a seven-district town hall meeting talking about seeds and transportation and the like. Now, it was a one-off, okay, so it wasn't a regular thing, but if they could do it once, I mean, we could do it twice, maybe, you know. So think about ways that we could use the net in real time. Queensland is sort of my favorite state in terms of e-democracy. They have a civic engagement policy, which then supports e-democracy policy, which then supports e-democracy unit, meaning like three or four people whose job it is when they go into office every day is to say, how do I help citizens interface electronically, participate in the government? That's their job. It isn't just sort of a side thing they were added to. It's actually their job. And so they have a really good part of their democracy portal takes you into a consultation system. And you can actually choose to share your results as you submit comments. And you can actually see the percentages for the multiple choices as, you know, as they come in. So they had a consultation on the tobacco policy. Now, obviously, this is a parliamentary system, which may change how and who would do this type of thing. But you also have the idea of online deliberation, online events here at Students Speak Out as a project by the Citizens League in Minnesota. And basically, how do you do an online event for 2 weeks, 1 month, 1 year, whatever, to engage a specific audience or a special audience on a specific topic to create a value-added exchange, not just an open-ended political jamboree, but something that creates some value that's unique. And that's another great model. When I walk into former Canadian MP's office in Winnipeg, and I had a meeting with him, right? So I had a meeting. I didn't know whether he was there or in Winnipeg, or sorry, in Ottawa. And most people who go into his office wouldn't know that he had an ISDN video connection. You know, now that the net's getting faster and faster, I mean, why not get the equipment to all of our elected officials that have remote offices and whether they're a state legislator or a member of Congress so that you can meet via net-based video with your elected officials. Rule of law. So this is like a big deal now, I think, because what I figured out is that almost everything that I've seen and began pointing out here are dramatic exceptions to the rule. There's a lot, and these are spread out from many different countries. And for the most part, if we actually want it, and it actually is democratizing, we actually have to mandate it at some level or fund it at some level. A lot of the more innovative, like in Nevada, you can go to the legislative website and actually, you know, do some Q&A and some polling type things. It's because they used to do it by phone, and that had a history, right? So a lot of nifty things that I found out there are based on a tradition that comes back before the net emerged. At a minimum, like I think our open meeting law should be changed to require not just announcement of a meeting on the bulletin board outside of the office, but also on the web. Not to get rid of requirements to publish in newspapers, but that would make sense. And I don't know if anyone knows about this, but it's still my understanding that the House ethics information, you know, all those travel documents and like, they're pretty much locked, available on a computer in the basement. They're not on the web. Why would we, public web, why would we collect ethics information at any level of government and not let the public have access to it from their homes or from wherever? I mean, it boggles me. And so any ethics information that's collected should be and must be made accessible via the net, or you should just stop collecting it, really. I mean, that's how I feel about that. Number eight, promote dissemination through raw access to data from decision-making systems, blah, blah, blah. This is actually really cool, and I have some examples, and I'll explain in a second. So federalspending.gov, you've heard of that. That's like one of the feathers in our country's cap, right, for e-democracy. And in Poland, they actually have FOI laws that require standardized releasing of budget information from local government. So they have like a big network system there. Well, and I've been looking for lots of information actually on spending. Governors put out their budgets all the time, right? You can get the budget document, but to actually find out how the spending is occurring is much more difficult. In Yalova, Turkey, they actually had a system where you could go in and see what was in the bank that day. you could also go in and you could see the wealth declarations of the various officials, and this one person, he drove a Mercedes. So if you saw him driving a newer Mercedes or some other car, you know, something might have been up there, may have been a bribe or something. Now, The problem with this system and a lot of the experiments that I've seen in this space is that they're actually tied to the party in power, and they're not part of the law. And so when that party lost power, the next party came in and got rid of it. It's gone. Same thing happened in Flanders. They basically had six people working full-time on e-consultation, and the new party came in and said, how dare they try to force us to interact on the internet? We will interact with the real people. And of course, when they came in, they turned off that internet system. So reuse of government data. There's a really exciting opportunity. This is kind of gets into the whole Web 2.0 kind of thing. But basically, taking raw data from government, in this case, Chicago crime data from the police department, and making it useful, extra useful, and doing things that governments aren't supposed to do with it, right? So, like, you know, we compare taxes to kind of like getting a certain level of service, but it may be that it could be used for something more that goes beyond the mission and isn't justified to spend tax dollars on it. So in this case, maybe it was justified, but they basically here take crime data and you can map it out, and here these are the homicides, the first degree murder for about a month. Yeah.
Interesting point, this wasn't the government
that did this. Well, exactly. What I'm saying is that if the government can make the raw data available, which they did, then someone on the outside can reuse it. And there's another example here. They work for you in the UK, right? So they actually scrape the Parliament's website. And they've created your ability to get various search notifications. So you can type in a keyword. Whenever that word is spoken on the floor, you get an email notice. Now, ideally, groups like My Society wouldn't have to scrape. Ideally, they could go to a sort of a repository, get the XML, and plunk it right into their system. And GovTrack is a group in the U.S., and I don't know, are they the main ones that scrape and other folks use?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, use their data.
No, that's not exactly a group.
Exactly, Josh Trauber. Yeah, good guy. And so, we don't, let's just try and figure out how to make that more organic. So number 10 here, let's see, we're doing good for time. So I'm going to shift gears a little bit here, put on my little e-democracy hat. Whenever I write something, I have to put something in about what I'm doing a little bit. So for what, all these years I've been volunteering with e-democracy.org, and then I subsidize it with my business and my speaking and the like. And recently became an Ashoka Fellow, which gave me a really nice 3-year stipend to do this for real. And I'm one year in now, and it's allowed me to focus on what I believe is the most transformative. At least what I've experienced as being most transformative is the local up approach. It's trying to figure out how to allow citizens to see the results of what they've done online or any kind of form of participation. But I really think that there is a need for nonpartisan convening approaches, whether they're funded by government, by media, public media, by universities, foundations, business, whatever. They all can contribute something to this, but it's not just sort of taking our old view of what public interest was and putting it on the internet. It's actually trying to think about what of this medium can we do differently and how do we resource that. That's a real challenge. And I want to talk about sort of what I'm focusing on today with e-democracy. Actually, I gave a speech in Mexico, so I had this as my top 5 list. It's beyond the article now, right? So I started thinking about, well, how do we begin listing out the things that we as citizens can do? So imagine yourself in your neighborhood or in your city. What can you do? And I think one of the key things is a simple concept, but we have public life, right? So let's try and figure out how we can build our public life online, not just our private life. How can we get candidates to make public promises about how they'll use the net? And actually, last cycle, is the new Attorney General Cuomo in New York had some promises. Deval in Massachusetts had some promises. A few candidates have mentioned using the internet in new and unique ways. We need to get lots more promises from candidates this cycle about how they will use the internet to make government more open and accessible. And that means asking questions in the right spot calling to attention those candidates that have said something so that others will join the bandwagon. Much easier to get them to follow through on it if they promise ahead of time. As individuals, we can get involved with our time and our money. We can ask government to do more. As someone who worked in e-government, 2 emails was a revolution back then. Hey, look, 2 people have asked for this kind of functionality, and I could use that to go up the chain. And often you find you have a whole front line of folks in government that do a lot of these websites that are very passionate about what they do, and they really need your help to work their way up the chain to get the resources they need or the permissions they need to implement some of these new features that we would like. And we want public space online. And here's what I mean by that. Mall of America, great public space? Not really. It's a great private space with public aspects. Facebook, great public space? No, it's a private space with public aspects. Media websites, most of them, you know, it's actually a media property. You know, they own what you post. So we really need actual public spaces online. And many of those have to be created. Advocacy, we're good at two things in the United States in particular. We're good at raising money and making noise online. We are excel at that. And so online advocacy is natural. People do this because they have passion, and so people get together and they organize for a dog park, right? That's natural. And actually, well, folks in Austria also don't like dogs are organized as well. So they're all the spots people have found a little dog do on the sidewalk and inserted the flag. So when I'm thinking about this, the challenge that we run into is sort of the Wild West of the Internet, sort of no one knows you're a dog kind of thing, people behind aliases. And the need, if you really want to have a strong impact in a community building up, you kind of need some decorum, some civility. You want it to be relevant. You want people who have power to pay attention to it. And while blogging nationally has democratized punditry, it's influenced who's like on the TV news thing, at the local level, it's like the opposite. It's like taking where you used to be able to sit face to face and have a good conversation, now you have a blog which you often know who the author is, but the comments in there, or the reader comments on a lot of local newspapers, I mean, that are anonymous, that I don't know whose mission these media groups are now pursuing, but it's just because you can have, you know, lots of insults and flames doesn't mean that you have to, I don't think. So some real issues there to navigate. And a lot of folks think this is almost like a year old now. Now it's going to, I should put Facebook up here, but the blog, right? You know, and everyone needs a blog, 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 blog. And the reality is that most people don't have the time to maintain a decent presence on a blog. And if you don't have a blog, you're a second-class citizen in that environment. And you can comment on blogs, but unless you have your own, you're not really building your reputation. You're not building an identity. And so you need to think about the fact that it isn't just blogs or isn't just one tool or another. It's trying to find that right mix. And so what eDemocracy.org does is we create these things we call issues forums, the online town hall, a 24/7 place where people in a local community can come together and discuss issues that matter to them. We require real names. We don't let people post more than twice a day. Why? Because we use email and web as a mix. You can choose like a listserv, get all the email, or you can choose no email, or hopefully in the middle you get the digest version, which just tells you what's new, and you click through the website. When you build a forum like this, we have 1,000 people on our forum in Minneapolis. That's the first one that went local in 98. It's not what you email, it's who reads what you email. It's not who you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know, right? And so if you can actually build an audience that can change a community or has access to resources, then you motivate actual average citizens to figure it's worth their time to participate. Like a lot of people think of the net as an alternative to whatever, you know. And our model is to say, well, how do you map out power in a community and put an online commons right in the middle of it? And when we open a forum, we require you to actually recruit 100 people before you open. So if you ever go to, if you ever been to Yahoo Groups and you typed in your neighborhood or something like that, maybe 3-4 years ago you would have done this, or your city, there would have been an e-list, and there would have been 3 members. So the technology is really easy. It's the human side, the organizing side, which is actually quite difficult. Some topics on our forums, I'll show you the list of 10 cities in a minute. Schools, support for veterans, neighborhood parks, water quality, feral cat problems. We have a new forum in Christchurch, New Zealand, big problem with noise from the racetrack. You know, lots of different issues. And during campaigns and elections, Christchurch just had an election for mayor. Almost all the candidates on the ballot were interacting. At one point, the facilitator had to say, you don't need to be a candidate to post. Now, that's a really weird problem to have. Normally, politicians just stay away from this stuff because it's just not tangible enough in terms of who's really here. Politicians want to know kind of who's there. And so we kind of like say, well, if people actually are there who they are, they'll be more powerful and we make it a little more friendly for politicians. One of the key things that I found is you need to give people a choice of their technology. So this is, it looks like a web forum, but it's also an email list. It also has web feeds, so it looks like a blog sort of to Technorati or something. But a lot of folks sort of hate email or hate web, right? And then if you, the local of them in particular, if you choose one technology over the other, you've lost half your audience. And there's a natural monopoly. If you create a forum locally that actually has agenda setting power, it's really hard for someone new to enter that space. And so we don't want to use technology to exclude half the audience. We need to give people choice. And that's something that we do with a tool called Group Server. We start with a service club. It's kind of like a local democracy committee. I think Rotary Alliance Club 100 years ago, right? It took a while for them to get to 20, 30,000 each. Maybe someday, 100 years, we'll do the same kind of thing. We're in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Roseville, Winona. We got money from the British government a couple years ago to actually set up some forums over there. And I think, you know, citizen juries kind of came over from the U.S. to Europe about 15, 20 years ago. That kind of bubbled over. But at least in the last 3-4 years, I think we're the only American democracy idea that's been imported to Europe. So that's kind of, you think of the time. So they're working there. And we're also starting with neighborhood forums. And we have a grant to do some rural forums in Minnesota. And actually, we're going to do a neighborhood forum in a high immigrant area of Minneapolis, with like mostly Somali, and so and Somali and aging white hippies, and so it should be really interesting to see what kind of dynamic we can build there. Okay, so I'm almost done here. A couple of challenges I want to mention here. If you're trying to create public space online, you have to build it in a trusted way, right? And so how you fund it matters. The people in England want the government to fund it. The people in the U.S. want citizens to fund it. You know, we did a survey. But ultimately, we're trying to figure out how to scale this thing up, now that we're in 10 communities. There's a whole sucking sound from social networks. You know, everyone's kind of going on the newest thing. And I just think it's really important to think about the difference between publicizing your private life or your business life and making local public life accessible anywhere, anytime. They're different. Now, you could maybe do some of those types of public life things in MySpace or in Facebook, but ultimately, who owns it, who can shut it down, all that kind of jazz matters to us. Once you have that foundation in place of a local democracy chapter, it's not just about a forum to talk about local issues, you can begin to expand into other things. So we built a wiki right after the bridge collapsed that allowed people to share links and user-generated content quite quickly, and it became a real source for lots of the other media sites that had, again, their whole collection of user-generated content. We also used the wiki for drafting grant proposals and figured out how to kind of do things a little more interactively. The reality, though, is that people they'll read it, but they don't post a lot. You need to provide some leadership in a wiki environment. In 1994, we did an online candidate debate among candidates for U.S. Senate, and we did it last year for candidates for governor in Minnesota. Get some funding for it. This is the 10 questions, which is where you could put videos up, and we were the partner in that, and you could vote, and the candidates were encouraged to respond. But something we did, it was kind of fun, is we actually allowed people to respond via YouTube and Flickr and other tools for our debate. And if you just take an MN Politics, it showed up in our our very simple mashup. So it was kind of a way to have some fun. And I'm a big believer in asynchronous online candidate debates, like we did in the governor's race. We blog about what we're doing. So I think there's a real failure of technological determinism. You know, I talk about cyber optimists and people who say the internet is inherently democratic. And sure, parts of it are. But for the most part, I don't think technology is going to drive this. It's people and their political values and what they ask for, which is going to drive it, in my opinion. People do expect more and more two-way. And most people in power, whether it's media, government, or advocacy, are still pretty much one way. And unfortunately, still today, I mean, our private lives really dominate, and we don't have public opportunities. I don't know what I got here. Let me just say that I think that ultimately each generation has an opportunity to use the tools in front of them to shape democracy for themselves. Not just future generations. And my sense in general is actually people have to rebuild it every generation. And so we happen to be in an era where we have access to all these online tools. And I think it's really on our shoulders to figure it out and make it happen. Thank you. So So this is a couple links here. Just so StephenCliff.com will take you to lots of stuff. Do Wire. Democracy's Online Newswire is a site that I've used to sort of exchange information on e-democracy. It's not as active as it used to be because I'm really busy with my nonprofit, but I have a set of online communities of practice which are two-way, which is called Do Wire Groups. And there's one that I'm launching, still recruiting for, called the U.S. Democracy Online Exchange. And the idea is to gather people who are interested in nonpartisan-based e-participation efforts, whether you're in government, media, civil society. There's probably about 20, 30 of us there now, and once we get to 50, and there might be someone who would be involved in edemocracy.org, might be involved in an online voter guide, might be involved in a government portal with the democracy section, or you run the politics section of a media site, trying to create a place where we can trade notes, and other links. And then there's also a link, I did a bunch of case studies for the British government, and I commissioned, I was editor on these, but I wrote a lot of briefs from concepts around democratized navigation to elected officials' videos, e-notification, and so they're like really nice, short, concise little articles. So if you're looking for like can-do, how-to kinds of tips, pretty useful stuff. So we have time for, let's just do a couple of questions. And then we'll go to a break for 5 minutes to refresh, and we'll come back in, and then we'll start us on a discussion about these topics and many more. So any questions before we break? Yes. If you could push the microphone button.
Can you talk a little bit about the idea of the fight in the public space? Who owns the public space? Is it government? And if it's government, does it get shut down when the price changes?
Exactly. That's a great question. And I'll be brief on that right now. And let's part of the discussion because I think it's a big challenge because there are spaces that have public attributes that are privately owned, like theoretically or legally. eDemocracy.org's public spaces are owned by our nonprofit. And it's because we've constituted ourselves in a certain way with certain bylaws and due process, all these kind of quirky things that sites normally claim ownership, we don't, that it's a functional public space, like National Public Radio, right, is a public-ish thing, but not really. If it's government-run, then it is a legitimate public space, but then we have the First Amendment and constraints on what government can or can't do, and so then there's a huge fear factor that they can't do anything, and so they just prefer not to have much interactivity at all on the public site because of that fear.
Follow up on that, Steve. I've thought about that a lot. I think that in terms of we have a precedent, which is national parks and public parks, right? I mean, we have laws about how public parks are run and how national parks are run. And they could disappear when the next administration comes in, but they don't because of the pressure that's built up over time for preserving public spaces. So I think we need to think about how to build up that same kind of pressure for public spaces online.
Someone talked to me about libraries. I mean, they're public institutions, but so they buy some books and other books they don't buy. You can't scream and yell, you know, in the library, but you can whisper, you know. And the challenge online is that we defining speech in a way that says that disorderly conduct. I don't know. It's a challenge. So another question before we break. Yes. Push button.
How do you develop less expensive, more accessible tools? You've got your local group server. Where I am in Maryland, most of the citizen advisory committees, which are quasi-public entities, civic associations, use Yahoo groups. I didn't mention the advantage of Yahoo groups is it's free. None of these groups have any money, and it's easy to use. The problem is it's very primitive. I think was fine 5 years ago. Most of the people doing really exciting things. Alan here does advocacy software. You know, it's great, but he has to earn a living, so he has to charge for it. So you know, a lot of good advocacy type software, but that's actually not at all appropriate for these type of civic things. That's why you built yours. So how do we get from here to there? I think there's infinite demand, but it's incredibly price sensitive in the market. and my bidders. So how do you get you there?
A couple of thoughts. That's one of the reasons I promote the idea of open source in this niche, in that what a government does in Europe is what an NGO, foundation, university group would do here, is what a media group might do in another country. But if the tools can be shared, no matter where then you find the money to pay for it to be built, if you can create that engine of sharing, the value can be exchanged. But clearly, whether it's National Science Foundation or a thinking about what's the internet version of public broadcasting, you know, CPB, if there's something that, well, it may actually be, you know, what money is being spent by CPB on public broadcasting, right, on local stations, and are there requirements for them to release their code back into other, for other exchanges? Because, like, in Minnesota Public Radio, there's a whole bunch of democracy-type things, like build your own budget and the like, and so maybe there'll be ways to leverage that. But, I mean, the truth is that unless you provide, like, a shared infrastructure for lots of small groups, they're just going to use the commercial services, which may be okay, maybe the best thing for them, but then if it is quasi-governmental, what about records laws? What about, you know, archiving? What about advertising and all these different things that may be an issue? But I think it's a big challenge. I'm hoping in Minnesota to somehow plant the seeds for, like, an online public hearing platform and, you know, raise some money so that we can basically add the features that allow us to do one of these online events. And not only could we do it with some foundation funding on a special topic, we could partner with the legislature to do it on a topic that's of importance, or with a state agency, and they figure out some sort of fee-for-service way to allow them to basically use a shared infrastructure. And by hosting it outside of, you know, the website that I used to work on, we may be able to build the economic engine of the broader community, and because the government itself maybe, you know, they haven't been able to justify to legislators why they would need to spend $200,000 to build something.
Okay, that's the end of this recording, and I just wanted to encourage you to check out edemocracy.org. That's E with a hyphen, democracy.org. You can check out our project blog for lots more updates on related topics. You can also check DoWire, dowire.org, for lots of other related e-democracy networking opportunities. And finally, stephenclift.com, which will have links to everything, including my Publicus site, which has lots of articles going back many, 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 many years on these topics, as well as other speeches. Thank you.